weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to Johnny B and Afric for the afternoon entertainment. It is Wednesday, April 17th. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On. Coming up between now and 7pm, David Snaid is standing by to chat soccer as the Champions League continues to entertain and the search for a Republic of Ireland manager continues to frustrate. Damien Lawler has the latest Gaelic Games news stories and we'll hear from Dublin's Kieran Kilkenny while Nadine Doherty and Aoife Murray chat Camogie Finals, Ladies Provincial Championship. And we most certainly won't be skirting around the Scorts debate. As always, if you want to have your say, you can text us on 51552, WhatsApp 087 187 9200, or we're on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Good evening. Welcome along to Game On. Great to have your company here on Wednesday for the next hour. I'm in the company of David Snaid and Nadine Doherty. Nadine, how are you?
I'm very good.
Good.
I'm a little bit wet and cold.
Okay. Well, hopefully the next hour we'll pick up spirits and entertain our listeners with an hour of sports chat. Might be that entertaining when we get to the managerial saga, David, but we'll wing it.
I think that's pretty much what the FAO have been doing. That wasn't even a planned tee up. That was actually just off the cuff.
This is very true. This is very, very true. News headlines today. In rugby, Munster assistant Mike Prendergast has dismissed speculation that Anton Friche will be leaving the province this summer. The centre recently expressed his intention to play Test rugby for his native France and is expected to be included in their squad for the summer Test series in Argentina with head coach Fabien Galthié, likely to rest some of his frontline squad members this July. So good news for Munster rugby fans. And not much really else brewing on the news. No news in the world of sport. David, you're on the beat. Oh, any breaking football stories?
One of the things probably is a broken record, but even the fact that like James McLean came out today and called it a shambles what's been happening with the FAI and the manager search, and it is something that's just been kind of, there's a sense of fatigue has kind of grown over for a lot of people, even just like anecdotally speaking to different people outside of, say, football, who would be football fans more so, but even just now covering that at this point, and it's kind of, It's got to the point now where you're kind of feeling, well, whoever they end on, and whoever gets the job now, they're going to realise that how far down the pecking order that they've actually been, and it's disappointing in a way. It kind of makes the job almost harder for the next person coming in and puts more pressure on it in terms of providing a bit of impetus, really, because it's obviously going to be the two friendlies in June, and then you're going to be straight into the Nations League campaign that's going to be happening in September, which again is going to be kicking off against England. That's going to be the first game, so it's just been
baptism of fire.
Yeah, but it's just been a kind of, like, even this week with the Chris Hughton stuff that's kind of come out, that they've gone back, the FAI have gone back to kind of Chris Hughton and speak to him to kind of sound him out. And I know, even just obviously when that kind of came out, just getting a sense of speaking to people who would know him and saying maybe it wouldn't be that likely. I know he'd been away, he kind of had stepped away from things even beforehand, just think there could have been a personal issue going on, and then he was away, obviously he's been away on holidays as well, and even speak to people, say they'd be, would find it unlikely that he would take the job. Now we've been kind of told that from other people and from other candidates, should I say, at different times, and things can change and stuff, but maybe it could be another job on the hand for the FAI to kind of convince him. But it does kind of even seem to be the modus operandi of what's been happening, where they had kind of got a bit of a short list and speaking to people, and they don't want to deviate too much from that. But then there's times where someone like John O'Shea, who wasn't even originally interviewed for the job, he kind of looked as if he was going to be getting it almost by default. Gus Poyet, who wasn't one of the people that they originally interviewed, again, he was also someone that they went back to, or say who they went to, kind of out of the blue a little bit. And then obviously Anthony Barry, another one who was originally kind of sounded out about the job, and then they'd gone back to him in recent weeks. And then you had the kind of, I'm sure, but now with people, like, I'm even talking about it, and I can kind of even feel a bit weary, and maybe there'll be football fans who are feeling the same. But even the situation with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, where that came out of nowhere to a degree last week, where there was bookmakers putting out PR spin, and ordinarily it's not something you would pay a huge amount of attention to, but then, like, only because of obviously working on this story for the last while, like, myself and my colleague Gavin Cooney in the 42, like, we kind of had been made aware that Solskjaer was someone who was sounded out, and that later emerged. We were, obviously, had been informed of that, weren't we, now, 17th of April. We were kind of knew that around March time, and we were kind of biding our time, because obviously you have to trust your sources, and we were asked not to divulge that, at that point. And you're kind of thinking, well, it's come out of the blue. And you're like, well, knowing how the FAI have been operating, they clearly may have just gone back to someone who they had went to before and had knocked them back. Obviously, it turned out that wasn't the case, but it's just kind of gotten to the sense where we're coming on to a point now where it was, 22nd of October, November time when Stephen Kenny went. But let's be honest, everyone knew what the writing was on the wall before then. You know, it wasn't as if this is something that should have been sprung on them on the way. It's just been carried out. Just been very frustrating. And then this week as well, like, again, it's just not emerged, but obviously been released as well, that Jonathan Hill, the CEO, is leaving. And it puts the FAI in a kind of a state of flux. You know, they've got an interim CEO now as well. Like, they haven't got a manager. They might have an interim manager for the next set of friendlies. We don't know. Like, there was supposed to be an announcement due on the manager this week. It's one of the few times, like, it's been an interesting one in the sense of over the last few years of covering the Ireland team and covering kind of situations like this. But even just where, like, it was this week, last week, should I say now, at this point, where the FAI were actually, for the first time, being the ones actually briefing journalists, saying, yeah, there's going to be a decision and it's going to be announced and it's going to be, as you're told, Wednesday or Thursday of this week. And yet in the space of a few days, those plans are up in the air again, totally just gone.
They shot themselves in the foot in that regard, in being so definite that there would be something early April. Perhaps keep your powder dry.
Well, and this is the thing with Mark Cannon, this, like, the director of football, like, he was the one who kind of made that plan in the statement. That was something that nobody would have expected when that was done on the back of announcing John O'Shea as the interim manager ahead of those March friendlies. So that was the back end of February time, and you're thinking, like, why would you have done that? And, like, he was saying at that point then that it was to do with existing contractual obligations, why he couldn't name the manager. But, like, unless you have a pre-contract signed with someone, or you can announce it and say, why, it's ridiculous that you would even announce that. And, like, you've seen people like say Kevin Kilbane, obviously former international, Damien Duff, another Centurion international, just talking about the absolute, like, shambolic nature of this. James McLean coming out again just today and saying the exact same. And you're kind of thinking, like, why would you put yourself in that position to actually be tied down, and, like, unless you had it absolutely nailed down? And there's, like, different versions of truth. Like, you speak to people who'll say, and it's bizarre to think it, but that in one of the playoffs for the Euros, when it was Georgia and Greece, that it was effectively a shootout for who was going to be the Ireland manager, whoever lost. And it was a case that that's part of the reason why Gus Poyet, and I reported this on the 42, in the build-up to that playoff, Gus Poyet was sounded out. In the days after it, Gus Poyet was offered a job. Like, and he turned it down on the basis that he wasn't able to bring in the staff that he wanted, because the financial package overall that was on offer, he wanted to bring in one assistant with him, which was Mariko.
Financial thing, or
it was an element of both, where it was like he wanted to bring in four staff. He was able to bring in, at least guaranteed to bring in, one on the package that was going to be available. This is what I had been told. And then it wasn't suitable. Then he stepped away from it. Then he's kind of thinking, right, you're going to be at Euros in the summer. There'll be jobs coming up after that. There's going to be naturally jobs coming up. I think he's based in London. He's been based in London since, obviously, his playing days as well. There could be jobs coming up in club football. So he kind of stepped away from it. And you're just kind of, it goes back to that announcement. Why would you say you've got something lined up when it's clear now at this point that wasn't the case, that it just wasn't? And, like, it's just been, it's like, if you had almost come out and said, you know, like, this search is obviously it's prolonged now, and it's kind of dragged on. We're in a situation where we're not where we anticipated, where we are, where we wanted to be and where we should be. Just almost hold your hands up and come out and say that. Rather than keeping this kind of almost like a kind of veiled silence about it, or kind of saying that, well, it's part of the plan and all this. And even in the announcement with John Hill talking about, like, a structured kind of plan for the next CEO, like, you just wonder who's going to, how you're actually going to make the decision and how you're actually going to entice it. I mean, it's gone on for this long. It's just been absolutely comical.
You feel sorry for John O'Shea being put in a position.
Yeah.
And he was on media duty yesterday completely separate to the FAI, has to be said, promoting the Europa League final in the Viva Stadium. But, of course, all the questions to John is going to be what's the story, and you kind of feel sorry then for John, because it was like, well, I nearly know as much as you guys know.
I know. And it's even just put, that's the thing, but he'd be important in that position where he's kind of, obviously he came in to do the job as, say, as interim manager, and it was very obvious even from like people, players coming out and obviously talking very positively about him and saying about the influence he had and just his understanding of them. And then obviously the results, you're kind of looking at it was a tame enough friendly against Belgium, like tepid enough game. Obviously they had, were playing in the next, a couple of days later after that, and then obviously there was the manner of the defeat to Switzerland as well. So it wasn't exactly as if it was a campaign where that in a campaign it's two games interim, but like his thinking was, well, like there's two games to try and make an impression. Some people have come out there and said maybe some things, aspects of that camp didn't actually maybe impress some players in terms of, which I find a bit bizarre that they didn't like being on the training pitch for as long as maybe they were. But sure, when you're on, if you're in international football and you're not going to be together for, you're not going to be around each other for that long, maybe making the most of every minute is what you should be doing. But yeah, it's just almost as if, like, maybe it could be a case of, if they feel at this point last week, you're kind of thinking it's going to be John O'Shea, almost by a nature of default. Again, people are like, even Kevin Doyle was saying at RTE's coverage of the Champions League, just give it to him now at this point, you know, in terms of, yeah, he hasn't got the experience in terms of a manager, all the experience under as a player, and he's obviously been working as a coach at various levels for the last few years in Cuba with Ireland. But it's like, it shouldn't be, obviously you get the job on a merit, it shouldn't be a case of just giving this job to someone by default as well. Do you know what I mean? If you feel as if this is a person who you can trust and back to go and deliver success, well then you give the person the job, you offer them the job. It shouldn't be after this amount of time, even though we're talking about the weariness of what's gone on for the last number of months, to get to a point where you feel as if you're appointing an Ireland manager by default, just beggars belief.
And again, that's putting John in a very difficult position if he ends up getting it by default, which is... final one on this, David, because I do want to chat about the Champions League. Listen, we have been speculating, but in terms of your learned opinion, who do you think is the front runner at the moment?
Honestly, I don't know, and there's no point trying to bluff in terms of the nature of how this has gone.
You have
like,
to be honest.
If you had spoke to me this time on Friday morning, I would have said John O'Shea will be the new Ireland manager. That's how I didn't see any other indication of what was coming in terms of other candidates who have knocked back. The fact that the FAI were tied, they had tied themselves to this April appointment, because that's what Mark Canham had set out. And you're thinking, well, there's no one else is coming. That's why the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer stuff kind of piqued a bit of interest for a few hours, and kind of even actually in the build up to the going to cover that Shells Bowes game, where it was like leaving the house to cover that game, thinking one thing, you arrive and you realise actually it's not happening at all. That's just how this seems to have gone. But maybe, as I say, Chris Hughton seems to be coming back into the conversation. That maybe is someone who they're going to have a chat with. I don't think they would have had a chance that over the last little while because of his family situation where he's been away and he's been on holiday in Africa visiting his wife's family. But I think he's someone who they're going to be having a conversation with. Like, depending on, do they decide to wait until after the Euros now in terms of the summer and wait until see who might become available after the European Championships? Personally, I think you might as well do that now. Like, you've waited this long and it's dragged on this long. There's no point in appointing someone who you're not absolutely committed to just for two friendly games in June if you feel you might get someone who's got international experience, because that's, again, seems to be a remit for this job. Like, it's something that Neil Lennon said that he didn't get the job for was because the FAI came to him and said the reason why you're not is because you haven't got international experience. So you would think then it's prudent to actually, bizarre it is to say, wait until the Euros and get a manager in, because like realistically what's a manager coming in for like the games in June now going to actually like achieve? It was
how much input would Jonathan Hill have in it, and is that a massive spanner in the works and delay, or is it Mark Canham, Paddy Bonner, the more kind of football?
Like Jonathan Hill has been involved in terms of speaking to the candidates when they've got to a point where they've been obviously getting interviewed fully from a league. Apart from speaking to a couple of different people, and I'm sure this will kind of properly be fleshed out in terms of how it's operated, but seems to be a case that possibly in terms of, say, say Mark Cannon as the director of football would make an initial approach to say candidates and be speaking in terms of what he anticipates how the role is going to be from the football technical side of things and what they want, and then obviously when it comes down to the brass tacks of finance and it comes down to everything else and other obligations, I suppose that's when Jonathan Hill and even to a degree maybe Paddy Bonner has had more of an impact in it. Although you hear conflicting reports, then even this is again adds to a little bit of where a bit of the nature of your thinking, well, what's going on here, is because you see, well, Jonathan Hill maybe was having a bit more of an influence at some point and wanted to be a bit more kind of front and centre for when certain stuff was happening, like certain stories maybe, and that was coming out about Roy Keane and what he would bring in the presence, that would have maybe kind of triggered with maybe certain elements of the FAI and the commercial side of where they're looking at as well. And then you would have heard, say, that Paddy Bonner would have been heavily involved, but then you hear kind of conflicting stuff on that as well, and it does seem that Mark Cannon is the one who's driving this, which that's his job, he's the director of football, but he's also been at a point where he had to go searching for a women's manager. He's been implementing something that personally I would feel in terms of the infrastructure plan and the investment strategy that's supposed to be laid out for Irish football of far more importance for the long term health of the game. And yeah, that was something that was completely overshadowed, and maybe politicians probably almost used as an excuse not to properly examine and to go into more detail with the Oireachtas committees when obviously everything came out about Jonathan Hill and the pay and how he had to repay that and how that was dealt with, and that was obviously the writing on the wall really for Jonathan Hill. But to go back to that original point on who's going to be the new Ireland manager, at this point now no one can say for certain because the FAI don't even know.
Extremely frustrating for many football fans and for everyone involved in the game. John O'Shea and Brian Kerr have to be retained by the FAI, says one texter. Brian Kerr has to be retained by the FAI in some capacity, says another. Boston Lowell is Ireland's midfield solution, says Ciarán and Mead as well. So
yeah,
perhaps all opinions.
I know he's been watched, obviously in terms of with a view to obviously the senior, because his progress has been very impressive. You know,
need a manager first to call him up. Perhaps there is no John O'Shea isn't currently the interim manager.
No, like, so but this is it. No, so he's not.
Even beware to have interim 2.0. We shall see. Champions League. Plenty of entertainment last night. Over the last couple of weeks, to be fair, as I said, Champions League is keeping our graw for football alive. We're a bit downbeat with the managerial search and the saga, but it was great entertainment last night. We're hoping for more entertainment.
Just in time for when they actually change the format of it for, isn't it, for next season?
Yeah, and it's about like 74 matches every night or something. It's like, stop tinkering with it.
What, so people have said it's because it's maybe partly down to the away goal, in the way they've obviously gotten rid of the away goal rule, and maybe that's...
Well, I was a traditionalist away goal man, but last night I think I might have been swayed because of just the drama of like, oh, if they get another goal, it's going to extra time, penalties and everything else. Perhaps last night was a good example of the away goal being eradicated.
Yeah, possibly. But then like, I wasn't very good at maths and skill, but you would like to see something over a longer sample size before you make it. And sometimes you can just have great games of football with great teams, and or with teams who have deficiencies, and maybe have one team gets a sending off, a bizarre sending, a gas sending off, and then obviously just seize the initiative. And then obviously with the Dortmund game as well, with Atletico Madrid, which is just, like I say, poor Simone, I'd say that's probably going to haunt him in terms of, especially for what his teams are right now, for with the defence and all. But I don't know, if you go back to say the first legs of the last games as well, and obviously the games that are going to be tonight, the Madrid and Man City first leg in the Bernabeu, and obviously Arsenal and the Bayern Munich game.
Yeah,
like I wasn't expecting those type of games in terms of how City came out in those games, and like 3-3 and then 2-2. Maybe you expect some of it with Arsenal sometimes, because at that stage they haven't been at that level in the Champions League for like 14 years, so maybe like they could be a bit more kind of open, or maybe a bit more naive, and obviously Bayern took advantage. But in the City game especially how even some of the games were in the Premier League with City and Arsenal, where it's very tight, and even how Guardiola is like very kind of sometimes like defensively minded in terms of solid or whatever, but like the way they came out and just attacked, it was almost as if like the away goal rule was there. Do you know what I mean? In terms of like, you have to go out and get that goal. Because like, remember obviously Ferguson during the 90s and 2000s, you know, he used to say nil all was almost like the worst result you'd have away from home. But like, that City game last week, and it just sets it up so well for tonight as well. Because obviously if you go back to when, obviously when, like when City absolutely demolished Madrid on the way to winning the last time, like that kind of almost like sets City at that bar, at the level of where they're at. And they kind of, I felt as if in the first 10, 12 minutes of the game in the Bernabeu, they were threatening to almost do that again. The way Silva obviously cut them out for the goal, the free kick. But then just the way Real Madrid responded, it just sets it up. It's going to be brilliant later on.
Will they pull away from them? Will they demolish them, or will it be a tight affair?
I don't know if they'll demolish. This is the thing, like, City at home against anybody, if they're on it, are so capable of doing that. But are they going to do it against Real Madrid? I think isn't Camavinga or Tchouaméni, I think, is suspended because he picked up that yellow card in the first leg. I'm almost certain that it was Tchouaméni. But it's just like, it's one of them where we're talking about, say, the away leg. It's 3-3 in this tie, so you're thinking like, how do you approach it? If you're Real Madrid, are they capable of just almost like soaking up pressure and then hitting on the break, or do they have to play on the front foot? Like, they're so used to that's how they play. That's what Real Madrid, no matter what, are going to be expected to do. That's what's going to make it so interesting in the sense that, like, will they be the ones who can almost take the initiative? That's not something I don't think City will even be allowed to do. City are going to be the team who are going to have to dominate the ball. That's basically how Guardiola, that's how he does it. He's not going to be I can't imagine it's going to be like, right, well, do you know what, like, it used to be the thing of with Guardiola, it used to be one of his selections of overthinking with selections, and that maybe caused him not to obviously win the Champions League for so long until they did it last year. I can't imagine he's going to be overthinking with his own kind of tactics for the game to almost exceed that initiative. I just don't see that being the case, and I think he is going to be in another game where it could be back and forward. And then at times, like the way Madrid were able to find that space, especially down the sides, like obviously when Kyle Walker wasn't there, and get in and attack from down the flanks, you would think that that's where Madrid are going to look to exploit again. Whether or not Kyle Walker starts, because I know he was back on the bench for the last game against Luton Town in the Premier League, didn't come on. You're kind of thinking, right, well, you would normally anticipate, if you're bringing a player back for such a big game against Real Madrid, you throw him on for a half an hour against Luton when the game is won. But he didn't do that. And like, there's definitely vulnerabilities there with City, which Madrid were able to exploit, but they just still have so much at the other end of the pitch where, like, you would have to make City favourites. Do you know, you would. It's mad to say it against Real Madrid and probably make it eat your words, but Man City at home, regardless of the opposition at this moment, you have to make them the favourites.
Because of their quality under the pitch, I don't think it's a raucous atmosphere at the Etihad. It's not the intimidating atmosphere, perhaps, at home when Manchester City are playing. Arsenal, Bayern Munich then, in Germany, we're talking about home advantage. Do you think that might swing things in favour of Bayern München?
Like, even with this, you're kind of thinking, you would think, I made the point earlier about, say, Arsenal being at this stage of the competition, like, it's not somewhere where they've been for like 14 years, wasn't it? That's like getting to the quarter final, and you kind of felt as if, again, you kind of felt as if in the first leg, they looked for the time as if they could keep Bayern at arm's length, but they just weren't able to do it. Obviously the combination of maybe a bit of a goalkeeping mistake coming out, rush of blood to the head, and then obviously Bayern punish it. There's still a fair bit of work to do, but then they punish us so ruthlessly. But then Bayern in domestically this season have just been an absolute rabble. Like, it's the reason why Thomas Tuchel is going to be leaving. And like, you can't say for certain that Bayern Munich will, like, normally you would say, you know, they're just going to be too experienced, too strong, they can overpower them, they've got obviously the quality, and they should have all those things, but just the nature of how this season has gone, you can't say for certain that's how it's going to go, like, you know what I mean? Because like, Arsenal, again, it's like such a cliche to say it, but like, if you look at the calibre of player that Arsenal have, especially in that final third where they can just have those moments to like, pick you apart in terms of obviously Martin Odegaard, and then obviously Bukayo Saka as well coming, he'd probably be thinking after possibly should have had a penalty last kick of the game, Although it was his kick into the goalkeeper
he might be thinking. I think many other people would be disagreeing with him.
I know, maybe it's like, I don't know what time. I don't think the teams are out yet for those games because obviously it's an 8 o'clock kickoff, isn't it? As well,
yeah.
Tonight,
but now Real Madrid do usually reveal teams at about 3 p.m, judging they're very early.
But you cannot if you are Mikel Arteta be thinking, all right, do we sacrifice a Champions League quarter final that's so evenly poised and you've shown in the first leg you can are up to it here. It's not as if you're already chasing the game. Mm. Maybe say Liverpool in the Europa League now against Atalanta, who obviously will still want to win the Premier League, and unless they produce something spectacular, they're gonna be going out. They have to go for them. It's just how they would approach it. And if you're thinking, if you're being bold about it as a manager, and in fairness, Arteta has been, Bayern, there's going to be a nervousness there. There's going to be a kind of a little bit of vulnerability that you wouldn't know is associated with Bayern Munich at home in Europe, because their record is phenomenal at home. But because of the nature of how that season's gone, there might be that little bit of vulnerability. But then there's times where teams have struggled domestically and they can pull it out of the bag in Europe or in a cup competition as well. And I would love to see Arsenal in that game just not so much go for it, but try and take that initiative early and not almost see what kind of mood Bayern are in, or if they fancy it, because if you put them under that little bit of strain early, and maybe the home fans in front of their own fans, maybe they could turn on them a little bit, especially considering Leverkusen have just been crowned champions. Yeah. But
We shall see. Real Madrid team news is in.
I
knew it would be, yeah. 6 o'clock, I think it came in, so 2 hours before. Lunin, Carvajal, Rudiger, Nacho, captain, Ferland, Mendy, Valverde, Camavinga. As you mentioned, David Tchouameni suspended. So Cruz, Rodrigo, Bellingham and Vinicius Jr. is their starting 11. So Real Madrid, plenty of stars there. David Snaith, thank you very much. You're free to go. Really appreciate you chatting, as always. Lots more to come. We've a Gaelic Games trifecta. Nadine Doherty, Aoife Murray and Damien Lawler all coming up on Game On. Stick with us here on 2FM.
Game On.
GAA.
Now, RTE Sport Gaelic Games reporter Damien Lawler is with us to chat Gaelic Games. Coincidentally enough, as is tradition here of a Wednesday on Game On. Damien, you were speaking to a Dublin footballer who is an ambassador for the Aer Lingus College Football Classic that we have been previewing on the show. The College Football Classic taking place in Aviva Stadium on August 24th. You were speaking to Kieran Kilkenny, not specifically about the Football Classic, but certainly ways that we might get a bit of inspiration from American football and how we promote Gaelic Games.
Yeah, he's a huge American football fan, Shane, and I guess with all the buzz around the Irish GAA players and being in the mix for an international player pathway programme place, I felt that, a good area to have a chat about. But again, anytime you turn on your TV these days, your smart TV, I don't know what apps you have, Shane, or anything like that, but certainly in my place here, I finished watching The Dynasty. And I finished reading the book about it as well, and that's the New England Patriots story told basically through Tom Brady, Bill Belichick and Robert Kraft, and a few of the teammates. And look, it's absolutely fascinating stuff, even to study Belichick's demeanour and his kind of surly manner and the way he deals with the press and ignores all the controversies. But at least he fronted up and turned up for the documentary. I think before that, obviously, the COVID pandemic, The Last Dance, captivated nearly the whole sporting community in this country and across the world as well. And I think if you're into Formula One, how they sell their packages, absolutely incredible. And there's no shortage of soccer documentaries that if you turn on Netflix or Prime or Apple or any of them. And it just got me thinking too, very, very rare you see it in the GAA. We've had a few good ones, going back to Pat Comer with Galway in 98. Loose Horse and RTE have collaborated on a few gems, the likes of Paddy and that, over the years too. But access has been really, really limited. It's not something that the GAA does. And obviously Dublin footballers wouldn't be known for going around juggling balls in the air and doing somersaults after scoring goals or anything like that. But I decided to chat to Kieran about the whole promotion aspect of other sports. And as you say, with the Aer Lingus Classic is coming to town, that'll be more of a pageantry than anything else. And I just decided, throw it at Kieran, see what he thought. And here's what he had to say, Shane.
from my perspective, I think it would be amazing to see something like that. To see, I know Roscommon did it previously, and
Galway did it in 98, yeah.
Galway in 98, a year till Sunday, yeah. Two phenomenal documentaries and a great insight. But it'd be great again now in 2024 to see the level of detail and professionalism that's involved with Gaelic Games. I think it would be incredible, and I'd be open to seeing something like that, and maybe after I'm finished, but I'd love to see that, a proper read, like a Netflix documentary on the Gaelic football team. I think will be really incredible. And you know, I thought it was cool that, you know, Matty Clare got to go into the Wicklow setup during the week, and to see what's involved with the Gaelic football team, because I thought it was I thought the article was good for giving people and fans and supporters an insight to what a training session looks like within their county team.
Yeah, 100%. A last question for you, Ciarán. And again, you're playing, so all you're concerned about is playing. I know that. But your former manager, James, got in as chair of this new football committee. And from what I hear, they've met very, very often. Jim is certainly on top of his brief. But what will he bring to a kind of a setup like that, Ciarán? What are the things that he used to bring to your team as well?
Well, I just hope that he brings us, and I know he will. Jim has an incredible love of all things related to our culture and traditions, and he loves our sport, so he's the right man to be there to lead now. And I know that in his mind he wants to grow the game as much as possible and make it as put it up there as much as possible for supporters, players, everyone to celebrate our games. Like, and definitely at the moment, from a player's perspective, it suits players, you know. But if you're looking at the bigger picture, we're missing a trick there. I, from a fan point of view, I loved it when it was in September, because from a teacher's point of view, we can like do, we can have the flags up in the school, you can have colouring competitions, all that kind of stuff. You can, you know, there's real buzz in the schools, and you can really promote the games there. Whereas now in September, there's nothing there for the kids to connect them with the Gaelic Games. So I think we're missing a trick from that regard. And I think, do whatever it takes to grow the game, to, you know, fill the stadiums, and, you know, really looking forward to seeing the movement.
Well, hopefully that football review committee does work out positively. But just on the topic of promoting the game in perhaps this style of documentaries, like, I remember reading one of your books, Damien. You had great access to, I think it was the Waterford Footballers a few years ago now, to be fair. But access, that's the big thing here. I mean, it's like the third secret of Fatima trying to get a starting 15 from the Dubs, never mind anything else. Like, access is the big thing here. It's all well and good saying we should have this, but I mean, getting a starting 15 out of the Dublin panel is like the third secret of Fatima, never mind sitting down with them for a year.
Well, come here, we're a long way off, Shane, and you're right. Like, 2009, it was the year I got married, and I think I spent a year with the Waterford Footballers. I got into the dressing room, we were over in London with them, they got beaten by a pint. I'll never forget that day. They were going for promotion to the league. They had some unbelievable wins that season and the season before. Got beaten by a pint by London. I remember being back in Cork Airport, and the players got slagged off. And the manager, John Jackson Kiley, turned around to somebody who slagged them in Cork Airport and said, you know, sure, what do you expect? Like, London have the pick of 30 million people, you know. And stories like that prompted me kind of to do that book, because they were called pub team by certain pundits. But to this day, I'm still in touch with some of those lads. And I think they're the real heroes of the GAA, if you're being honest about it. But to get to the access level about what would be required for a Netflix documentary, we're a long, long way off that. I do think it's possible. I do think players coming through this generation are more determined to say what they feel on their own platforms, not necessarily through our medium anymore, Shane, but they have their own little social media accounts, and I think it suits them to be out there. It suits their brand. A lot of them are pretty prolific on Instagram. So I think maybe you might have to do it with one player and get access to one player season. I think that probably will be the starting point. But to get it onto TV, there's no point just doing a documentary for the sake of it. It has to be absolute quality. It really does. Mm. You have to give a behind the scenes insight. But as I discovered doing the book, sometimes you just have to be there to listen, just to shine a light on it. You don't have to come up with any new formula. Like the year I was with Waterford, like, we had all sorts going on, you know. I mean, one guy got an operation to get a tumour removed to play a league game. He got to postpone the operation so he could play the league game. You know, you had other ups and downs throughout the year, and It was Division 4 at the time, but it's one of the things I'm most proud of. And I you know, a dream of mine to get something done documentary-wise as well, Shane. But we are a long way off it at the moment. I mean, players really, especially in post-match interviews or pre-match interviews, you know, they're not really free to say what they want.
Yeah.
Simple as that. And there is a code of fear out there for maybe being dropped or being punished for saying what you feel. Simple as that. Or drawing unnecessary attention onto a team. But effectively, it doesn't really matter. If you're playing in front of 82,000 people, what does it matter what a journalist has... But there's not that much bad critique out there anyway. That's what I can't understand, you know?
No, completely. I think it was, coincidentally, one of the Waterford footballers gave a great post-match interview there a couple of weeks ago as well after their win. You mentioned perhaps it might be an individual to follow. I tell you, Johnny Glynn wouldn't be a bad individual to follow. Big boost
Stop
for the Galway Hurlers.
Stop giving my ideas away to the listening fraternity of Game On, will you, for God's sake. No, that's the one to do, really. And I suppose Johnny would have to go through the official hoops of getting clearance from Galway County Board and Henry, so it'd probably be a long shot.
Very much. But that is a big boost for the upcoming championship now.
So Johnny's on the go since 2012. Obviously, I think he moved over to New York in 2015. Really successful career over there. Settled family, the whole lot. You know, crucial part of Micheál Donoghue's campaign in 16-17. Going on to win the All-Ireland, flying over and back to compete for his county. Tried it for a little while after, but then kind of, you know, the effort was too colossal. But, you know, kept going, was part of the New York football setup. Transferred then club to hurling and football over in New York, and I think was last seen maybe as a selector for the New York football team with their great historic win over Leitrim last year. But came home, played for Ardrahan in the club, and just did what Johnny Glynn does, like caused absolute havoc. Well over 6 foot, unbelievable in the air, but a skillful hurler and strong as an ox. And I think based on that then, you know, Galway reopened the communication lines there. Maybe they were never closed, but he had been doing a fair block of training there around Easter time with Galway, but before that as well, since maybe the turn of Christmas. And I'd say they have it down to such an extent now whereby he can maybe commute over and back, but spend a certain block of time here and maybe work from Ireland as well, but while all the time going back to his New York base. Do you know what? He's an immediate focal point anyway. The game of hurling has gone possession based, obviously, playing through the lines. But if you can do what Limerick did and isolate Seamus Flanagan and Aaron Gillan with that long diagonal ball, I'm not saying Johnny would be that prototype of player, but he's an outlet for a long direct ball in, and he gives Galway another kind of option. Eamon O'Shea is coaching their team, probably big emphasis on the forwards. There'll be a lot of space creation, a lot of movement, but Johnny could be your focal point. And, you know, it let's see how it pans out. Don't want to put too much pressure on him, but it's another lovely subplot for the season ahead. And you know what, Shane? It's been a slow start to the season. It always is every year. So we need as much excitement as possible.
No, for sure. Let us finish our conversation on comments from GA President Jarlath Burns, who alluded to the fact that perhaps traditionalists will be happy. We might see September All-Ireland finals again.
The interesting thing about that was only a few months ago, Tom Ryan in his annual report, the Director General, kind of, you know, dismissed that or kind of poured cold water. So it's really refreshing to see Jarlath coming out. And doesn't have to be disagreement between anybody, just his own views. And of course, dual counties, there'll be massive pressure for him not to switch that. I'm talking Galway, I'm talking Cork, probably maybe to a lesser extent Tipperary, because their football championship is not a lengthy one. At the same time, those counties will argue, no, we need a block of around maybe 15 weeks, maybe a little bit less, maybe a little bit more in Cork's case, to finish off our domestic championships. There's no way it can go back to September. You're not thinking of the dual counties. But I suppose Jarlath is cognizant of all the debates going on around the provincial championships at the moment. The crowds are down. Everybody's saying the weather is so terrible. It's too early. Like certain counties, the bulk of their year is, you could argue, is over. You know, you could.
Mm.
And I don't think Jarlath's burying his head in the sand over this. He's coming out and talking about it. My own feeling all along is that, you know, I, from a really selfish point of view, I got a week off there in August last year, or 2 weeks maybe. I couldn't believe myself. The sun was basking down. I was there. My God, this is fantastic. I don't think we're going to, I think maybe the end of July, Shane, it's still a little bit raw. I think maybe another week or two into August. I don't think you're far off the ideal scenario then. I think you're giving your counties ample chance and you're prolonging the intercounty season. At the moment, the intercounty season is about 36, 37 weeks. It's all wrapped up by the end of July. You do get a break and be into the club situation then. But a good club championship, not necessarily in a dual county, can be run off in a pretty 8 to 10 weeks, I think. You know, it has been done before in the pandemic, for example. So I think maybe somewhere around mid-August would be the perfect place to land. You're prolonging everything, but as regards the pre-season and the provincials, we'll have a chat about that another day. Let's see how the season pans out. But I think somewhere between Tom and Jarlett lies the perfect answer.
Yeah, here's hoping for a happy middle ground, perhaps. For now, Damien Lawler, thanks so much. Great chatting, as always.
Game on.
Camogie.
Now, Aoife Murray is with us to chat Camogie. Nadine Doherty is also here to chat LGFA as the championship throws in provincial action this weekend. But let us begin our conversation reviewing the weekend, because Aoife Murray, it was a cracking weekend of Camogie League final action. And in Division 1A, Tipperary bridged a long L gap and they won the Division 1A league title by the smallest of margins. Did it live up to all expectations for you, Aoife?
I think it did. In fairness, I thought it was a really good league final. Having somebody like Tipperary in the final with such a gap, with a 15 years since their last outing, you know, you'd have forgiven them, especially in Croke Park, you know, to have come out of the blocks a little bit slow or frightened away from the battle, maybe, Shane, a little bit with those kind of final nerves. But they just looked so comfortable and very much at home, which I think, well, for me personally, would go to a very positive championship, hopefully, and a competitive one. I think we always wished, and we were always trying to break that top three, plenty of conversations over the years on that. So I think seeing Tipperary be so comfortable handling that pressure, and one thing I wrote down when I was watching that game was, you know, they were just hanging in the fight the whole time. And I think that really is a sign of just where their mental strength is at. And to me, that was probably one of the biggest positives. But no, certainly, like, the game just ebbed from Galway going ahead, Tipperary taking them back, then getting that last minute point. To me, I think it was really positive for Camogie, which, look, in fairness, I think Camogie has needed a little bit of positivity over the last few weeks.
It most certainly was extremely positive. And will that emanate to other counties as well? You mentioned, like, Tip, I think they're the first county outside of Cork, Galway or Kilkenny to be successful in one of the two marquee competitions since Wexford in way back in 2012. Like, will this give hope to other counties that, do you know what, we can go on, we can challenge these so-called bigger teams and compete and win?
It absolutely can. I think even if you think about it, this is a Galway Tip final. We haven't had such a final in ages. We had a Cork and Waterford final last year in the All-Ireland. So Waterford breaking that ceiling and going in and playing against Cork. So I think, in fairness, you know, it's not just a Tipperary example. I think what Tipperary showed, as opposed to maybe Waterford in the final last year, is if you have impact subs, you will absolutely be able to push those top teams. Not only push them, but you will hang in there and you can pip them at the very end. And that was the big thing, I think, for me, for Tipperary at the weekend, Jane, was their bench changed it. You know, the game was slipping away from them. And Quirk and Julianne Burke, and to me, Julianne Burke was one of the biggest game changers that came in. She brought the whole thing into an absolute fight in the middle third. And I think that's what Tipperary showed, I think, to other teams out there, is you've got to have 18, 19, 20 plus players to actually break, I suppose, that top three. I think it showed in the final last year at Waterford that their bench was weak and they didn't have that impact, especially losing Vicky Faulkner there right at the start of the game. So that, to me, Shane, is that's how, I suppose, a template for other teams, maybe that are in fourth and fifth spot, that's how they can break those top three, is have some impact. And that to me is what they probably showed to other teams.
In injury time, goal by Grace O'Shea broke Wexford Hearts and snatched victory for Dublin in the Camogie League Division 1B final, 2-10 to 2-8. When we're talking about belief and what a league title might do, is it fair to say the Dubs needed this because it's been somewhat difficult for them in the recent past?
Yeah, and I think, in fairness to Dublin, they've shown promise over the years. You know, they might have a really good year, they might dip the next. They've had a huge issue with, I suppose, turnover of management, Shane. So there hasn't been a huge amount of, I suppose, consistency at leadership level. So I think for them to get over the line, especially in the manner in which they did, you know, Wexford were shooting the lights out throughout the whole league. And I think, in fairness, if I was to tip one last week, it would have been to Wexford. So for Dublin to, again, a bit like Tip, they stuck in there. They constantly, you know, the game was just going away for them and they'd bring themselves back into it. And again, staying in right to that very last minute, I think for Dublin, it is just a reward for, I suppose, a lot of hard work that is going on in the background. I can see it in the county at club level, but certainly, hopefully, they can take that now into a very consistent way into the championship and be one of the challengers. Equally, I think Wexford had an excellent league, so you know it's not all lost for Wexford either. So I think if they can take the positives out of the weekend, I think those two teams will have a very positive year.
You mentioned plenty of entertainment over the weekend. Westmeath overcame Derry in the Division 2A final. Armagh overcame Leitrim 3A and in the Division 4 decider. Congrats to Tyrone, who powered past Wicklow. You mentioned the good news stories because, Aoife, there has been some frustration and negative news headlines because the issue of skorts versus shorts rumbles on. And is the biggest frustration that it is still an issue? It's still rumbling on, Aoife.
Yeah, and look, it's not going to go away, Shane. And that's the thing that frustrates me the most with the Camogie Association, is this issue has been rumbling on for years and years. Even when I was playing, look, it was a constant, I suppose, thorn, and it was a constant point of discussion amongst the players, management and county boards, even in my time. So, like, it hasn't gone away. And if anything, I think players are just finding more room for their voice publicly because their voice is just not being represented. I suppose, and what frustrated me the most is not so much that the vote wasn't passed. It was the fact that there seemed to be such a delta between what the players are saying and the players are voting for versus what their delegates are going to the association and voting at Congress. And that is the biggest issue. I know for as a player back in the day, it used to be what upset me the most was that if my delegate from Cork went and voted against what all of us as players were saying. I remember always the contact rule, and we would be giving out to the Camogie Association about, you know, there not being enough contact. And they would just turn around to us and say, well, your delegates aren't voting for it. So that is one of the things that really, I suppose, irked me the most, because it's 99% of the players who want change. So, like, it's not going anywhere. And I would question the Camogie Association, because this has been rumbling on for so many years. I would love to know what they have actually been doing in the background, because it's probably one of my frustrations at Camogie's. They're not good at that public message. You know, they seem to not tell us all the good things that they're doing. So I would love to know, what have they done in the past 10 years to try and improve it? What conversations have they had with some of the players? Why do they not want to wear skorts? What are the issues, and what have they done with the manufacturers of that skort? So that's probably the question that I would have to come up with. What have they actually done to try and improve the situation rather than putting their heads in the sand?
Aoife, can I just pop in there and I suppose ask you a double-ended question? First of all, why do you think that disconnect is there between totally what the players want and the delegates, because it does seem to vary in each county in a sense? Like, you know, I know that the Dublin girls, they spoke at length with their county board and their delegate voted how the players wanted, and then, as you pointed out quite rightly, so 64% of delegates voted the other way. And second of all, and I agree with you 100%, it should be the Camogie Association who are engaging with their players. But perhaps if not, do you think with the GPA, maybe you have done already, but is there scope there for the GPA to do like a more thorough bit of research as well? Would that be on the cards?
On the GPA one, right, from my time within the GPA, there was a lot of work being done.
Yeah.
I remember sitting on a number of meetings where we would be speaking with players. I think the players were, I think there was a vote from the players as well, or a survey, I should say, Nadine. So I know at my time there, I'm not too sure what has been done of recent. I'm not on the board anymore, so I'm not too sure what has been done. But certainly in my time, there was a huge amount of back and forth. And I remember seeing the votes come through, or the surveys come through, I should say. And like, it was completely weighted in one direction.
Yeah.
And it's very hard. For me personally, Nadine, I like the skorts,
okay,
right? And I know I am obviously in the extreme minority, right? But when I saw that data come through, I know hand on heart, like, there was only one way that I could go to a Camogie Association and fight for. Like, you had to fight for the voice of the players. Like, yeah, it was so loud. It was, and that what irks me about the delegates, because they have to, and going back to your first point, like the delegates, they have to put their own personal opinion to aside. Just like me, I have to put my own personal opinion aside.
Yeah.
Because the voice of the players is so loud that all you could actually do, hand on heart, is go and represent that voice to the best of your ability. And that's, and listen, you're probably well aware, even from the ladies' football side of things, the amount of votes that go to Congress and delegates go and vote in the way in which either A, the county board wants to, or B, how they want to. Yeah. It might be very harsh and a very probably sharp way of reviewing it, but they cannot be going representing a 64% no when there's 99% of the players saying yes.
Absolutely.
So, and you'll find that with a huge amount of even playing rules, they'll go, in my time, that, as I said, about the physical contact, and we screaming for it, and our delegates going and voting against it because it's a personal opinion, or it is a group within the county board who maybe want to, I suppose, pay their respects and fairness to where the game has come from, the, you know, those lovely pinafores. So, you know, there is a complete, there's a completely gap there in maybe understanding and maybe a little bit of trust in the players.
Absolutely. It is a very important conversation to have. For now, Aoife Murray, thanks so much. Nadine, I do apologise. A very important conversation to have. There is provincial action to look forward to this weekend. A highlight being...
Dublin Kildare has to be Kildare undefeated, 22 games, Division 2 champions. Sinead Goldrick is back for Dublin. A lot of things are happening. It's a massive fun. I think it'll be a brilliant game. For me, Dublin are favourites for the All-Ireland at the minute. But that's the one to catch this weekend.
Okay, Nadine, Aoife, thank you both very much. There'll be full previews on the RT Sport website and indeed the LGFA website as well. That is all we have time for. Thanks for tuning in. Betta De Silva is up next. Lock in with the new music show, because Betta has the first Irish play of Fontaine's DC new track, not to be missed. Big thanks to John Farrell and Laura Lee Davis from all of the Game On team. It is bye for now.